track all of this. Yeah, this is the first of three, possibly four, revision sessions where we'll go over everything we've done. And as I said, what the idea is, we'll hopefully come back to it with a little bit more understanding, which will be good. And I'll also give you a bit more clarity about what's going to be involved in the exam. I've given that a little bit of thought this week. Although it's not 100% there yet, I think I've got enough information where I can actually share some information with you to begin to get you prepared about it. Well done. So let me just say what's going on the next 4 weeks, okay? So obviously this session here, we've got, like I say, 3 weeks on the Thursday where we use these sessions to go over everything. Seminars will take place as normal. The only thing I want to point out is next Friday, not tomorrow, but the following Friday, I've got to go to a conference, so I'm not around. So if I can just flag that up now, what I'm suggesting is if everyone can come to the Thursday session instead, so the one straight after this, if that's possible, just everyone just come straight to the following session. It'll be a bit tight in the room, but we'll be okay. But apart from that, just going ahead as normal. What I'm going to suggest with the last week, I think what we'll do with the last week of term before Christmas, we'll see where we are when we get to week three, the third week from 3 weeks from today. We'll see where we are. If we feel collectively that you need another session, we'll do it. Otherwise, what I think I'll probably do is have a sort of an optional drop-in where I'll get to the office and you can just pop in and see me if you need to see me. But we'll play that a little bit more by ear. And also, we'll do the same on the Friday session. To be honest, the Friday before you break up, the session takes place at 2 o'clock. Normally, it's not happening that. That's the normal. But I'll be there. But I'm aware of the fact that last Friday before you break up, that may not be happening anyway. So does that make sense? That's what we're going to be doing over the next 4 weeks. Plenty of time to do the prep. I've put this up as a prompt. Obviously, as we're moving towards the last few weeks in the preparation for the essay, the exam, it's really important that you begin to use Blackboard. Now, I think it was Jessica emailed me yesterday saying that I'm having some problems accessing Blackboard. Has anyone experienced any problems or, you know, any issues at all? You should just be able to access all of the PowerPoint slides, all of the recordings of the lectures, and all of the PDFs of the stuff that I've asked you to read. It should all be available on Blackboard. Yeah. All right.
They're not how they are in the lectures.
Really?
Yeah, they're like different colours. So when I first saw it, I thought, this isn't what we had in the
lecture. Oh, no, that shouldn't be the case. It shouldn't be.
They're all silver. So,
that's what we...
Yeah.
Right, I'll tell you what.
The information was all the same, but I didn't... Yeah. When I first opened it, I didn't look at the information. I just looked at...
What I need to make sure is that you're actually accessing the right musicology. You might be looking at last year's. Well, look at that. What we'll do, I'll try and finish this up sort of 10 minutes early, and we'll have a look. Okay, and what it might be that your version of Blackboard, sorry, PowerPoint, mightn't be able to open these colours. It might be that. We'll check that at the end just to make sure. Just want to make sure that you've all got access to this. We'll have a quick look at the end just to make sure. Okay, so let me just put all of this information here. I've already said this a few times, but we're at the point now where you need to understand this, so I'm going through it again just to make finally sure. I've already given you the date for the exam. It's the first week back in this session here. So first week back in this session, and it'll be 2 hours in this room. This lecture and the one straight after. You know there's two options, 50% musicology, 50% music theory, or 100% musicology. And you can make those choices now. What I would do is don't wait. I'm going to give you as much information as I can so that you can actually make these decisions well before you hit the exam. So you're not like spending 10 minutes thinking, what one am I going to go for? You know, think about that now. The music theory bit of the exam, I know some of you aren't doing this, but this is what's going to be involved in the exam. Okay? And we've gone through all of this, and in the seminars, we'll continue to go through this stuff. So, identification of modes, which we only did last week, modes of the major scale. And when I say both from and to notation, what I mean is you'll see the mode notated, you've got to identify it, and then you'll see the mode written down in a name, i.e. B-flat Dorian, and then you've got to write it down. You'll see it two different ways. Roman numeral analysis, in the way that we've talked about it, using both the numerals and the chords as starting points. So all I mean by that is you'll see Roman numerals written down, and then what you've got to do is write the chords next to the Roman numerals, and you'll also have to do it the other way around, where you'll see the chords written down, and you put Roman numerals next to the chords. So it's, again, looking at the same thing from both angles. You've got to be able to identify chords. There's going to be a bit of that in the test, so it's worth just going through that, revising that. There's going to be a little bit on secondary dominance. There's not a huge amount of marks in that, but there are some marks to be given. And the only thing we haven't looked at, in fact I said to one of the groups last week that we weren't going to look at it, but we are, I've changed my mind. Modal harmony. It sounds really complicated, but there's only a couple of marks in it, and I'm going to explain that this week. We'll go through that this week. So we've covered all of this, and we'll continue to go over this in the next 3 weeks, and particularly try and help those of you who are struggling with that, if you're going to go for the music theory side of things. And like I say, I think what I would like you to be able to do over the next couple of weeks is make a decision and start preparing for the route of the exam that you think is the best one for you. And you can talk that through with me if you want to. Now, what will happen, obviously there's the music theory bit, that's 50%. Yeah?
So what's the date again for the...
Off the top of my head, we'll come back on the 4th.
On an estimate, so...
Yeah, I think it's the 7th. Yeah, it's the 7th. We'll come back on the 4th, and it's on the first Thursday back at this time. The musicology side of it, right, it depends on if you're going to do music theory or not, okay? Now, if you're not doing music theory, what you're going to do is answer one question and document about 1,000 words on that question. I'm going to tell you what the questions are, okay, so you can prepare. Okay, so one question and you write 1,000 words. It's about two sides of A4, and I'll supply the paper. If you're going to go for purely musicology, i.e. musicology with no music theory, you answer two questions. Both questions are 1,000 each. And you've got loads of time. There's 2 hours for this. So there's plenty of time. And by me mentioning it now, you've got plenty of time to begin thinking about it. Like I said, don't come into the exam and think, well, what are we going to do? 50% this, 50% that. Come in knowing what you're going to do. And you should be well prepared then, so you can just sort of take it on from there.
Is that with 10% leniency?
Yeah. I'm not going to be going through, you know, sort of counting each word, but yeah, roughly around about 1,000 words, yeah. Yeah. You'll need that to answer the questions. Now, before we break up for Christmas, I'll give you the questions, right? I'll tell you what the questions are, so you can actually prepare for them over the Christmas. At the moment, I haven't quite put the wording together for the questions, although I know what the general themes are going to be. And what we're going to do is spend the next 3 weeks. This is why I said we need 3 weeks to do the revision, because there's 3 questions, and I'm going to spend 1 week on each question. And the final week, we'll see where we are with that. So the first question, which is what we're going to cover today, is going to be related to song arrangement and track. We'll do a bit of work on that today. Remember, we did that in week one, or week two, I think it was, after I did the gender introduction. We looked at that notion of song arrangement and track. Okay, so remember, bear this in mind. If you're doing music theory, you're choosing one of these questions. If you're not doing music theory, you're choosing two of them. You're going to do all three. Second question, we'll talk about this next week. Remember the three-way model that we talked about, the production of text, the text itself, and its reception. There's going to be a question around that, and we'll talk about that next week. Hopefully get you prepared for that. And last but not least, the third question is going to be related to what we've been talking about more recently, which, as I say there, is persona development. Remember the real person, the persona, the protagonist, that model that I showed you. What you'll get that model, and I'm going to ask you to talk about it. But what I'm going to do over the next 3 weeks is to suggest, in addition to what I've been saying, I want you to start reading. To get the better marks, you need to show that you've actually read additional material in addition to my lectures. So I'm going to suggest stuff for you to read every week. I know I've done this up until this point, but we're at the point now where if you decide, right, I'm going to answer this one here, you need to do this additional reading and make sure you understand it so that you can actually mention it when you answer the question in the exam. Does that make sense? That's better as far as I can get at the moment. At least you're pretty clear what's involved now. The only thing I haven't given you are the questions themselves, but once I've developed the questions, I will give you the exact questions before the Christmas time. Yeah.
In the exam, if you take 100% musicology,
yes.
Is there only two questions?
Yes.
And they're one of those three?
They're two of these three.
Two of these three.
Yeah. That's right, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Does that make sense to everybody, yeah? Yeah? Any questions or anything? Yeah?
This exam, let's take it anyway. No correcting or anything like that,
No notes. No notes. They'll all be in here, hopefully. Yeah.
When we write the exercises for the essays,
yes.
Is music playing in the background to answer the question?
No.
Strictly writing on the form somehow.
Yeah, you'll find when I give you these questions, I'm going to ask you to think what music you want to talk about. Does that make sense? So I'll not be playing you any music, but you come in. You know, if you're going to answer the song arrangement and track, you come in with a couple of pieces in mind. So you sort of prepare the question beforehand. That's what you can do from this point on and over the Christmas.
Someone who's going to be set in a different room. Am I going to be set in a different place? You would be there to supervise, or
what? Say that again.
Because of my DDS, all the stuff that I get extra time. I get moved to a separate room. So will I be set on a different day so you can supervise that and not shoot or anything like that?
Yeah. Can you come and see me about that?
Yeah, for sure.
Drop me an email and we'll have a chat. You drop me an email. Come and have a chat with me.
Yeah,
about that and we'll sort that out, yeah?
Yeah, sure.
So when you say you have to have a song prepared, is that then we send you what that song is so you can...
No, you don't have to send it to me, but all you do, you just think, well, what songs am I going to talk about when I'm talking about... So if you're talking about the persona in a piece of music, what's the bit of music you want to talk about which displays the persona in the music?
For you to understand that and see how real it is, you're going to have to know that music, aren't you?
I'll just put it in Spotify. That's what I do. If I don't know any music, I just listen to it on YouTube or Spotify.
Okay.
So I don't need to know the piece. It's fine.
Right.
As long as you do, that's fine.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, so let's just have an overview of... song arrangement and track. It is going back quite a while now. It was sort of week two we looked at this. Now, before, let's just see who remembers what the difference is between song arrangement and track. Who remembers what those differences were? Anyone remember? Yeah.
I think the song is where it's like the main melody and the main chords.
Yes.
And single structure.
Yes.
Like verse, chorus.
Yeah, that's it. So the song is basically just the basic melody, the basic chords, some idea what the form is.
Yeah.
And there's one important thing that we said about the song. The notion of the song as I'm talking about it, and that was it's got no sound. Okay? It's a sort of an abstract idea that's made up of a melody, chord, some idea of the form. But as yet, it's not been put into sound. To be put into sound, it needs to go to the arrangement point of view. Does that make sense? So when you put it to the arrangement, that's when you start to think, well, okay, it's going to be this particular form. This is the form that it's going to be. And the instrumentation is going to be this. The instrumentation is going to be made of two guitars, bass, drums, piano, vocals, and backing vocals. That becomes the arrangement. And that's broadly what the arrangement is. We'll look at this in much more detail as we go on. And what was the track side of it? Anyone remember that? The track.
The recorded, when you go in the studio and you get that recorded.
Yes. Yeah. So the track, it isn't that the record, let's say the record, because we say here, the discrete analytical layers of a record, right? The record is the final thing that we listen to on either MP3 or, a vinyl record or a CD or whatever it is, okay? That's the record. Well, what the track is, it's like the say, for example, you go into a recording studio and you put down a drum track. That's an element of a track. And what you get, you put down multiple tracks, don't you? Quite often you put a guitar track down, you put a drum track down, you put a keyboard track down. And when you combine all of those together, it becomes the record. And what you've got to do with this, we'll come on to this in a second, you've just got to begin to think about how you can, because if you read Alban Zach's book, and I've scanned the chapter of that, of his book, I'll put it on Blackboard later on today, suggest you read it if you're going to answer this question. He believes that the song and the arrangement and track, you can actually talk about them separately. He says they're ontologically independent. All that means is that the very being of them is separate from each other. You can talk about them separately. So, yeah, first and foremost, you think, well, okay, that's broadly what each of these three categories are. But you could ask the question, and if you've not looked at this with any real intent of thinking, how do I use it? You think, well, so what? So, what I've taken the liberty of doing here, if I can just bring this up. Just bear with me one second. Just... Now this looks like a real, and it doesn't matter if you can't see this, you'd better see it when you look at it. It's basically a mind map, right? It's a mind map. When you look at it, I'll save, well actually scan it, it's already on Blackboard. You'll get to see this on Blackboard, you'll get to see it much closer. But what I've done here to get you thinking about this is I've put the record in the middle. Okay, that's here. If I can make this a bit bigger, bits of it, so we can just move it. Let's see if I can make this a bit bigger, and I'll just move it around the screen. Yeah, let's try this. I might have to sort of just make it possibly 120, see if that... Yeah, that's a bit better, isn't it? Okay, so I've got the record in the middle. And then what I've done, I've said, well, okay, we can have the song, the arrangement, and the track. How can we talk about that? How can we talk about it? So, let's start off with the song. This is the record, okay, the song. These are the sort of things that you can talk about, and this was just me doing a brainstorm. I suggest using mind maps when you're preparing a question. When you're preparing an exam question, it's a really good idea. You don't have to use software like this. This is free, anyway. But just do it on a sheet of A4. And you can begin to get a bit of an idea of what the question could look like. So, for example, okay, what is a song? Well, the first thing that it appears to me, not the first thing, but one of the things, is that the copyright of the song, according to UK law, is actually split up into two parts, isn't it? It's split up into the music and the lyrics. So, when Lennon and McCartney wrote music, they got 50% each. 50% of the royalties each. That's the way that it tends to work. Now that becomes much more complicated when, we'll come on to it later, when a band composes a song. So when you get together in a rehearsal room, and that happens a lot, doesn't it, with band stuff, this is this side of things, where you get together in a rehearsal room and you jam out some ideas and the song develops out of a rehearsal process. What happens then is the copyright issue can potentially become a lot more complicated because you've got to think, well, who owns what? And you get quite a few bands, U2 for example, are one of the bands, who doesn't matter what they write, they always just divide the royalties up equally. So whatever song you're writing about, it's interesting to think, well, how was the song put together? And how is the copyright split up? And why is the copyright split up in the way that it is? What you normally find with a song is its mode of representation. Because it doesn't exist in sound format, it normally, you get it in a lead sheet. At one point, that's the way that a lot of music was consumed at the beginning of the 20th century, you know, before records came out. Sheet music was the medium, and people played that music on a piano. Now, moving across here, what you find is, and I think you'll agree with this, is you do find that songs are associated with specific recordings. Does that make sense? So we quite often associate a particular song with a particular version of that song. For example, when we played the song yesterday, 5-6 weeks ago, when we did this, and the Lennon and McCartney version of yesterday is definitively the version of yesterday, despite the fact that there's been probably another 1,000 versions of that song. So quite often we do associate the song with particular recorded versions, and what you've got there is that the song suddenly becomes associated with an arrangement and a track. Does that make sense? Does it make sense? So it's not just an abstract entity anymore, it's become real. But listening to Yesterday by the Beatles, which is a particular arrangement, and it's been recorded in a particular track. These are all things that you can talk about. Things like what happens in, I mentioned, in the days of Tin Pan Alley, what you quite often found is songs were written in basically in rooms that looked like small rehearsal rooms, a room with a piano. A songwriter wrote the song, then they gave the song to an arranger who arranged it, and then the arrangement went into the recording studio and it was recorded. So you got the song, the arrangement, and the track happening not simultaneously, but in a sort of a linear fashion. And quite often what you found in the days of Tin Pan Alley is quite often the person who wrote the song wasn't the person who performed the song. Now, that's interesting, isn't it? Because we take for granted these days, usually, a lot of the stuff we listen to, the people who perform the songs are quite often the people who've written them. And what does that do? For me, anyway, it appears more authentic when you've got somebody who's singing about their own experiences. And it's this connection, songwriters involved in the performance of their songs and the composing of the song. What sort of song is yours that you're analysing? Are they involved in that? What you find as well, you know, I mentioned the Tin Pan Alley days where you got people who composed music, had them arranged, and they went in the recording studio and recorded them. And you have this separation from the songwriters and the people who performed them. But what you found as the years went by is there was a notion of songwriters who basically composed for other artists. That's what they did. So they didn't write for themselves, they wrote for other people. And that's something that goes back to the certainly to the 1940s, the 1950s. What made me think about this is Ed Sheeran has just written a song for Justin Bieber, and it's still happening today, that Okay, you associate someone like Ed Sheeran as somebody who sings his own music. But he is part of that Tin Pan Alley tradition as well, where it links in to songwriters who write music for other people. So again, these are questions that you can ask about your own song. Let me just move this across a little bit, just to make sure I don't miss anything off. Yeah, I'm not going to go through all of these things. These are literally just a bit of a brainstorm. What we do find with songs, and what I say is you don't have to agree with these. This is just me rabbiting on about a song that's recorded. You can listen to it back. But we find that songwriters tend to be celebrated in the history of music, don't they? The people who write the songs are quite often the people who are celebrated. They're the people who get the biggest rewards in the music industry. The money tends to be the songwriter, either the lyricist or the person who writes the music, or quite often they do both. So we've got this sort of celebration in music history where people who arrange music, we'll come on to that later, people who arrange music quite often traditionally weren't as celebrated. But how do you think that's changed over the, say, the last 20 years? So songwriters are celebrated. That's the traditional notion in popular music. They're the ones who get all the money. The people who arranged it in the 1960s, say, they would have got a fee, and that would be the end of it. How has that changed in modern times?
Well, the performer is idolised. So even though everyone's like, well, well done to the songwriter, people are still... I guess it's more like fans. It's a different kind of celebration, though. Like, the songwriters are celebrated in a way with getting awards and stuff.
Yeah.
The actual performers are giving, awards in more like for their fans and stuff.
Yeah, so... Yeah, that, to be honest, that's one thing I hadn't really thought of. You know, performers these days are celebrated, say, about like One Direction. They don't necessarily write their own music, but they are celebrated. Songwriters still are. Ed Sheeran is a good example of that. But what I meant by the arrangement of the music, the old-fashioned notion of arrangement of music would be, say, the way George Martin worked with the Beatles, where they would come in with a what you could call a head arrangement, you know, basically just something played on the guitar or the piano. And then George Martin would say, well, let's orchestrate it. But to me, that fits in with the idea of, say, sampling. A piece of music which is made up of numerous samples, where that's a form of arrangement, as far as I'm concerned. Quite often, if a piece of music is sampled to a great deal, you're not getting any money off the copyright of the song because it's owned by other people. But it's a form of arrangement. So the modern day DJ, they have become celebrated. So there's been a shift in a way, to my mind, where, okay, songwriters still are celebrated, performers absolutely, although they have been, you know, Elvis Presley said, he didn't write his own music, but he was celebrated. So there's been a notion of performers, but arrangers being celebrated. You could go back to people like Quincy Jones, for example, who worked a lot with Michael Jackson in the 70s. But I think it's become, the rise of the DJ has had a big impact on the arrangement becoming important.
Do you think that,
in addition to the song?
Today, like, even though it's the same, so Elvis Presley never wrote a song, but on the records you can always see who did write the song.
Yes.
Do you think
yes.
It's just people don't know about these things? They assume, like, I feel that maybe back in the day they knew more about the songwriters, whereas now it's more hidden in the fact that...
Yeah, it's a good point.
Do you think that's changed, or do you think it's more that if you know about it, you know, and if you don't know, then you'll just assume that the person singing it for it?
I'll be honest, I don't know the answer to that. It's an interesting question, isn't it? If we know who've written the songs, we know the performers, we know the songs, but do we know who's written the songs?
Back in the day, I suppose you had to buy the records, whereas now you could just listen to it online and you don't have to read any small print on the front of your...
I think that's had a lot to do with it, you know. The way that we consume music, we don't have an album cover anymore, or even a CD.
Yeah.
I consume all my, I never buy, I haven't bought a CD for years. I listen to everything on Spotify.
Yeah.
And there's no information about the track, or no information about who wrote it. So it might be that the
song's
hidden,
it's just the fact that you just can't see that information anymore.
Yeah, so what happens there, the arrangement becomes more, in the track, the arrangement in the track becomes probably more noticeable than the songwriter,
yeah.
The people who instigated the song in the first place. These are the sort of things that I want you to talk about with the music that you're deciding to choose.
It's all well and good saying that the songwriters are hidden.
Yeah.
I think it's more the fact that generations I listen to, most popular music now, just don't care.
Yeah.
They idolise these singers or idolise these bands who don't write their own songs.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as they can, for people probably speak, but take drugs or go dance in the club to,
mm-hmm.
they really couldn't care less than mm-hmm. writing.
Well, that's an interesting thing to explore, you see. That's the sort of thing, just a little notion like that. You think, well, how can I prove that? That's like a sort of, I'm not saying you would do this for this question. You could do it for a bigger question, maybe the next one that you've got. Or dissertation, you know, that's a notion that you've got where people don't care. I think X Factor is a great example of that, where people just do the same cover version, the same songs every year, you know, Whitney Houston songs, Michael Jackson songs. There's no original material in that. It's all just placing an artist with a song. And I think that's indicative of what you're saying.
I also think it's because, like, a lot of people don't realise,
the viewing figures this year have begun to plummet, haven't they? I think people are becoming wise you know, you can only do that sort of thing for so long.
There's not much more they can offer, really, because there's so many bands that are really, really sort of like good in the public eye from the TV show.
Yeah.
They're creating more almost like as annoying, you know.
They've sort of
done everything that's different but still the same, if that makes sense. So they've got like a girl group and they've got like Kiddy, One Direction.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they've got, like, solo artists, but you can't really, like, find much more else there, you know.
And what you haven't got with that, you know, with that notion of X Factor, what you've got is a disunion of this, where songs associated with specific recordings and the people who wrote the songs performing them, that just doesn't happen there. And that might be the reason why X Factor is just associated with the lack of authenticity. With most people, it's got no authenticity at all. It might be sell records, but it certainly doesn't smack of being authentic. And quite often what you do with this sort of thinking, you get a good feeling about what you think is happening, and then you've got to sort of ask yourself questions why. If we move on to, let me just move this across a little bit and just talk about briefly, if I can just move this across. See if you can see this. Let's just talk about the arrangement. So the song, there's all sorts of stuff you can talk about with the song and how it links in with the arrangement. But things like arrangements, I think most of you in this room probably associate arrangements with one of two things. Actually, one of them I've not really put on. I associated my generation, it was rehearsals. Quite often I couldn't think of everything up in my head. I'd have an idea for a song, and what you go to a rehearsal with a band, and then you use the rehearsal process as a way of formulating the song. Does that make sense? That, as opposed to the Tin Pan Alleyway, where you just give it to somebody else to arrange it, I think in a lot of band-based music, that tends to be the way that it works. The rehearsal, it's very rare you get someone coming in and they know exactly what they want. Usually, the rehearsal process will be used as a means of formulating what the song is. And that's one of the reasons why you get so many copyright problems with bands who don't agree to divide the copyright up. I know with one band that I played in, the manager used to come round at the end of the rehearsal and actually divvy up. He used to literally say, well, 20%? Okay, 20, make it 25, right, 25%. And then he would get, that's the percentage of the PRS he would get at the end of the rehearsal. It happened at the end of every rehearsal, because the rehearsals were used to put together the song, which is where so much of the money is. And like I said before, some bands just decide to split it down the middle, regardless of who brings what idea in, because it sort of works out even in the end. The other thing I perhaps should have said in the arrangement, we've already mentioned the old sort of tin pan alley, but also I think computer technology. A lot of music is written using that, isn't it? You sit down at a workstation, you've got an idea for a song, possibly, and then you use computer technology to actually put the arrangement together. But by putting the arrangement together, quite often you're putting the song together at the same time. That's the difference to the tin pan alley route, where it's linear. Do the song, then do the arrangement. So much music today, I think, with technology, is put together simultaneously with the arrangement. And then what you ask, well, how do I know that? How can I figure that out? And that's the sort of questions you can ask with the song that you're talking about. How do you think it's been put together? How does the song and the arrangement and the track interrelate to each other? What you find with arrangements, the modes of representation, will be things like performances. So, for example, all the versions that you see on X Factor of the Whitney Houston classic, they're all different arrangements of the Whitney Houston song. They're all different instances of that one song. There's only one song, but numerous arrangements. And that's the way that they tend to be represented. In classical music, you get arrangements which are represented by a score. So you'll see a score notated. But you don't get that as much in popular music. You do get it occasionally. I've actually got on my desk in the office, it's about this thick, scores of all of the Beatles records. Every record they ever produced, somebody had actually taken the effort to transcribe them from the records. And I bought the book, but I did think, what a pointless exercise. Just what a, because we don't consume Beatles music like that. That's not what the point of it is it? We consume it through the record, not through the score. But they've tried, what does that do? It sort of authenticates it in terms of art music. It makes it appear to be more arty, because you're seeing it in a score format.
Some musicians as well, if they learn in a certain way, will be able to look at the book and to learn
the
words. Whereas other ones will just listen to it. So it'll be a lot easier for them to just read the book.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, someone like me, because I grew up with that, I can't make sense of it. That's why I bought it. But yeah. I do think it only captures so little of the arrangement.
Makes you realise how complicated some of the songs were.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And what I've already mentioned, the impact of arrangement on IP. It's interesting as well, you know, I was thinking this idea. Has anyone heard of the word altier? Someone like Madonna, for example, who, okay, she does write some of her own music, but what she does do as well is arrange everybody around her music. All of the artistic, the dancers, the fashion, the video footage, she's involved. She's got something to say in all of those things. It's a bit of a side point, that, but I think that's a really important part, being an auteur, in terms of how you put popular music together. The decision-making process that you can do as an artist. And last but not least, you know, we move on to the idea of the track, and I think there's less to say about that. And what we'll do, we'll finish off by listening to a couple of examples, just so we can begin to think about how you could approach this if you're going to do that. What you've got to remember in UK and American copyright law is that the track has got a separate copyright to the song. Do you all know that? A separate copyright. So if you record a song through, obviously make an arrangement of it, you record it, as the songwriter or songwriters, you get some copyright. The copyright of the track, i.e. the recording, is normally owned by the record company. That's why it becomes so problematic to sample, because record labels don't like giving that copyright away without getting money. You've got to get clearance, sample clearance. And that's why, certainly when I was a kid, years before your time, there was albums that were released, right, where there were cover albums, so you'd get all the chart hits that were recorded by a different band. And the reason they happened was because the artists, the people who wrote the songs, gave the copyright, gave them permission to do it, but the record labels wouldn't. So you couldn't release an album with the original, the compilation album with original artists, because the record labels wouldn't give the copyright away. That's why you don't say Beatles, you don't see any of the Beatles on compilation albums, even to today. It's not the copyright in the song that's necessarily causing the problem, it's the copyright in the track. And that's, I think, an important distinction that you need to be aware of. And I think what we found, I think the one thing that we found when we listened to that Beatles song, through the track, if you remember, is, if you remember, we played a version of Yesterday, and we thought we heard Paul McCartney's voice twice. It was like double tracked. And what we found out, well, how do we know that this isn't live? Because you listen to the song Yesterday, and you listen to it without listening to it in any detail, you could think, that's live, that. He's just singing it live in the string quartet. You listen to the details. How do you know that it's recorded through the track? And what we found was, is that his voice was picked up twice. It was picked up in the acoustic guitar mic, and it was also picked up, obviously, when he sung. So there was two versions of his voice. So there's normally sort of giveaway signs that it's been put together in a recording studio through the track. And what you can begin to do is to start to think about that when you're doing your music. And if you're interested in this particular question, what I suggest you do, how much time we've got left? 20 minutes. What I suggest you do, if you're interested, I'll give you a few things to read. I would start off by reading them, and as you're reading these couple of chapters, just think about music, one or two songs that resonate with yourself, how the ideas that I've spoken about and the ideas that these authors talk about, how they resonate with the music that you listen to. And then what I would do, if it was me, I would put together a sort of a mind map of how you're going to answer the question. Just start off, put the song in the middle, and put together a few things that you're going to talk about when you come into the exam. And you should find, I mean, I've been rabbiting on there for 20 minutes. So easy to talk about this, put this into essay format. It's not difficult if you choose the right music. The right, so, and you don't have to choose one, you can choose two if you want it.
Are you going to have to take any shorthand notes?
Not really. What I would say is sort of put together the mind map and just try and remember, just so you know what you know, don't put together something like this. You've just got, you know, have like sort of five bullet points or something where you can use that as the basis of what you're gonna talk about. I chose, just to give you a quick example, right, let's just listen to a couple of things for a second. If we thinking, you know, what could we actually listen to with this? Now, no one is probably anyone. I chose this because I've used this song the last couple of years because I'm hypothesising that most of you would remember this. S Club Juniors, Puppy Love. Most of you. That's it. That's an arrangement of it. Most of you remember this, right? Now, just to give you a bit of history of that song, right? A little bit of a history of it. That particular song was written in 1960 by a guy called Paul Anka. came out in 1960. We'll listen to a bit of this in a second. The next sort of big famous version was in the early 70s, when a guy called Donny Osmond did it. Did a different version of it in the early 70s. The next sort of famous version I was aware of was the S Club Junior version in 2002. Now, these are all arrangements of one song. And the original song was written by Paul Anka, and he wrote it, I think, when he was about 17, and he wrote it, it was to do with a breakup with his girlfriend, so it was a teenager writing about a real experience. And then I looked, I hadn't heard this version, but there's actually another version, which is actually not good. I'll listen to it, I might listen. But 2008, it's a slightly different version. But these are the sort of three key versions. Let's just listen to bits of them, and then we'll begin to consider how you could use an example like this in the essay. How you could use an example like this. So you've got one song, you've got three different versions of it. You can talk about the song, and you can talk about the arrangements and the recordings of the song. And you can begin to think how you could talk about it in the way I was talking about earlier on. You know, how was the song put together? What's the copyright of it? So on and so forth. You can begin to sort of build this picture. But let's just listen. We won't have time to listen to it all the way through, but let's just listen to, say, a couple of minutes of each one, just to give you a bit of an idea. I think what I'll do, let's start off with the one that you would have heard, possibly. Let's go backwards. So let's start off with the S Club Junior one. No more technology. Is it going to work? Hang on. Right, I'm there. Sorry. Stop and start. So, see if you can hear bits of the arrangement. That was the 2002 version, which many of you might have heard. Now, what I found interesting when I looked at this, I only spotted this yesterday, I compared it to the Donny Osmond one, and they're exactly the same length, literally to the second, exactly the same length. But listen to the Donny Osmond one and see if you can pick up on any observations. So this one's from 1971. In a different key, but it's got the same introduction.
And they called it Puppy Love. Oh, I guess they'll never know.
The arrangement is so similar. It's been copied by the S Club Junior. It's got the acoustic guitar in. Similar emotion in the voice. The voice is double tracked. You hear the double tracking in the voice being sang twice.
And they called it Puppy Love.
Backing vocals. Now, what I thought with this, you see, I knew the Donny Osmond record. My point of reference for that song. Would have probably been the Donny Osmond one. Your point of reference, what the, you know, I mentioned before about the, how you associate a song with a recording. you would associate it, I would imagine, with the Escobar Jr. one. I would associate it with the Donny Osmond one. And the earlier version, I asked my mother about this. This came out in 1960. She associates it with the Paul Anka version. It's the same song, but because of our age, generation, you associate with different versions of the song. And this is the original. Now, this one's a bit different. It's still got the strings, but it's got a different theme.
And they called it Babylon.
It's in mono. It's not in stereo.
Oh, I guess
I think it's in mono. It sounded like it on the...
How a young heart really feels.
Yeah, it's in mono.
And why I love her so. And they called it...
So, what you've got with that song, one song, three different versions, which version you, the version that you actually relate to, I would suggest, largely depends on age. And what you could do, if you just bear with me one sec, this comes up, it might be a bit small again, but if you're going to do something like this, where you're going to talk about perhaps more than one version of a song, you could put together a little mind map like this, where you know you put the song in the middle. And what's interesting, what I did with this, I just listened to each of the songs a couple of times and just wrote impressions down. Interesting how the original version obviously attempts to capture the listener in the emotionalism of the song. Has anyone heard that Michael Jackson song, She's Out of My Life? And there's a bit in the song where the song stops and he sort of pretends to cry in the song. It's not genuine, but there's like a sort of a little bit where he did it in a lot of the live gigs as well. But basically there's an emotionalism in the voice which was in the original one, and the other ones have attempted to emulate that. There's differences in the arrangement, but definitely the emulation of emotion. All of the versions have got strings in them. They're all in different keys. Now, you can ask why that is. The first one is written for a 17-year-old guy. Donny Osmond was about 12. It's written for a boy. S Club Juniors, I don't know how old they were, but young teenagers, weren't they? So it might be something to do with the people who are singing it, why the keys are different. And I've already said that the similarity between the S Club and the Donny Osmond one is it's a more or less a direct copy. It's exactly the same length. That's not a coincidence. So the arrangement has become so important. And I would imagine, I mean, my hunch, listening to all three of those versions, I would think the song's been written by Paul Anka. There's been an arrangement made of the song, and then the vocals would have been just put in at the last minute. There'll be no simultaneous song arrangement and track in this. This would be one after the other. Song written, arrangement recorded. That's my hunch. What I would probably do is dig around trying to find proof of that. And, you know, things like when I say the attempt to convey emotion in the voice, if I was writing an essay, I would try and answer how did it do that? How did it try and capture emotion in the voice? Paul Anka version, if I can just move this thing. What's interesting about the Paul Anka version, it's actually sung by the songwriter. So the person who wrote the song is actually singing it. That's not the case in the other two. It's in mono, where the other two are using what we would call the triangular mix. It's using a triangular mix with the bass, the vocals, the bass drum in the middle, the other instruments either side, as opposed to in mono. And that's just to do, in 1960, you've got a lot of mono recordings. That's just to do with time, really, that in terms of... You could ask that question, because it's sung by the songwriter, does it sound more authentic? I don't know with this song, because it doesn't sound authentic, period, does it? To me, it doesn't, because it's obviously a song which is designed for the mass market. So to me, that immediately sort of rules out authenticity from my own point of view. When you look at the Donny Osmond one, you compare it, it's interesting how the arrangement has got some elements of the original. So it's got the strings in, it's got backing vocals, but it does change the arrangement. He uses a double track voice, and it really sounds to me that the emotionalism is produced. Now, that's different to the emotionalism in the song being real. You get people who sing emotionally, but you also get a producer which is saying, put more emotion in your voice. It's coming from the producer. It's coming from the arrangement side of things, if that makes sense. The emotionalism, from my point of view, there, listening to that. And it's the same in the S Club Junior one. There is a producer telling those guys to put a particular type of emotion in your voice. That's what pop producers do. So again, that probably impacts the authenticity of the song. Last but not least, to finish off, the S Club Junior one. I think the big thing to talk about with that really would be that it's just so similar to the Donny Osmond one. What's obviously happened there, the arranger has obviously just copied the Donny Osmond arrangement and marketed it to a different audience. That's basically what's happened. So, you know, you guys wouldn't have remembered the Donny Osmond one, so it appears new. When I heard the Donny Osmond one, I don't remember the Paul Anka one. And you find that music, that happens with music. You quite often think you're hearing the first version of something, but quite often it's been released before. And I think what's interesting about this song is, in general, I think all of the arrangements try and sort of depict the sense of nostalgia. The strings, the use of the strings, they sort of evoke nostalgia. So what you could do, if you're going to go down this question, I'll finish up now, is do a little mind map like that. Come on in a second. Yeah, put a mind map together. And then use that as the basis of what you're going to talk about. What I would say you need to do, though, if you want to get the higher marks, is you've got to read this stuff. And what I suggest you do is think about, first of all, what's the exam going to look like for you? Are you going to do the music theory, or are you just going to do musicology? That would then determine if you're answering one or two questions. Think about what questions you want to answer, and then obviously only read the stuff that's associated with the questions. That's the thing to do. Obviously talk about the next question next week. But what I'll do, if you give me a couple of days, I'll upload this onto Blackboard. There's a book by Alban Zach, The Poetics of Rock. There's a chapter which talks about song arrangement and track. And what we expect to do to get the higher marks is, whatever you're talking about, you'll be expected to refer to this chapter. Now, I don't expect you to quote it. I'm not saying, you know, Zach says and remembering quotes. Not that at all. But just refer to some of the ideas that he's got in the chapter, in what you're writing. There's one page of Alan Moore's book, Song Means. I'll do that as well. I'll scan that and I'll put that up for you. And what I suggest you do, they're essential. There's a couple of additional ones. And what I would say, I'll put both of these up. In particular, this one would be an interesting one for you to read. Philip McIntyre, where he's basically just asking what a song is. So, you can go beyond that if you want, but I would say look upon this as being the bare minimum of what you would read and refer to in the question if you're going to do that.
Are there example essays that we would have on Blackboard to look over and to see how it's supposed to be structured?
Because they're handwritten. There's not the handwritten essays. So it's difficult to do that. I mean, and plus they're so short, they're only 1,000 words. It's not like a full essay in a way. But I would, what I would say, you know, just to finish off, I would say you certainly need to you certainly need to just plan it out. And if it was me, I would probably use mind mapping software or just mind map it manually to do
is
that.
Is it possible to see your mind maps go there, or are they going to be?
I'll upload these. I'll upload scans of them.
So in the song, if we do that song question, is that going to be a comparison of two songs?
Yes.
You
can choose to do that.
It's going to be down to the question, isn't it?
It is. And what I will do, I will give you the questions. I've got a group, some guys waiting outside, but what we can do, we can continue talking about this in the seminars. We'll continue talking about this downstairs if you want. If you want to pop down, we can continue with that. I'll also look at Blackboard in the seminars if you haven't got time.